Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Manchester in November 2024. This episode is all about nutrition and the policies and regulations that govern the sector. Our guest speaker is Lewis Wallace, Regulatory Affairs Advisor at Camden BRI.
So a bit of background for anyone not familiar with nutrition and health claims. In the EU, we've got a piece of legislation, which is 1924-2006, which essentially contains all the requirements that are needed for making nutrition and health claims, really all about ensuring consumer protection, but facilitating choice as well. So try not to be too restrictive, although arguably that is the case for some claims. Now, it's quite interesting with nutrition and health claims because the legislation applies to all commercial communications. So it's not just labelling, although labelling is more common, applies to advertising, that includes social media, and communications to healthcare professionals as well. So everything in terms of commercial communications. And this legislation has been in place for nearly two decades, so quite long-standing. Arguably, it's not kept up to date with current market and how practices have changed. And even the EU Parliament did a recent review and said that it's not fit for purpose. But how does that relate to actual UK law? So when we left the EU, this piece of legislation was assimilated, so essentially copied and pasted into our statute book. So we've had a chance to make some amendments and really try and fix some of these gaps. But we've not seen much change. There's been one amendment looking at changing enforcement actions. So now we can see enforcement officers using improvement notices rather than before. They'd have to build a legal case and take that through the court system. But top line level, then, what actually do I mean when I'm talking about nutrition and health claims? Nutrition claims, I always think clues in the name. You relating a claim to a particular nutrient or a particular component, and you're implying some benefit. So an example might be source of fiber. You've got a claim, it's related to a nutrient, and you're implying a benefit. You're implying a specific amount of fiber in that product. Other examples might be high protein, if you've got higher amounts, or you can go on the other side of that, where you've got quite low amounts, things like low fat and sugar-free, where you've got certain nutrients that might be of concern for consumers. On the other side, so health claims, I always think of these going one step further. So it's connecting a nutrient or a component with a particular benefit on health. So an example here, vitamin D contributes to the normal function of the immune system. So that's an exact copy and paste wording from the EU register. Never the most consumer-friendly messaging, and there is some flexibility, but it can be frustrating when you're trying to fit this information on pack or make claims based on this. But there is some leeway for certain general claims. So gut support, we see a lot of immune support, especially in recent years. But again, they're making a particular implication to a health benefit. So that's legislation. I'm going to look at now some of the gaps, or some of the gaps that I think should be filled based on how a lot of things have changed since 2006. And first gap is that on nutrient profiles. So when the legislation came out, there was this big intention to essentially stop products that were unhealthy or high in fat, sugar, and salt from making nutrition or health claims, which quite well and good, because as it stands, nutrition health claims, they can be used across all product categories. It doesn't matter if they're high in fat, sugar, or salt. And to me, you could argue that that's misleading to consumers. If you've got a nutrition health claim, might be a product that's high in fiber, but if it's also high in fat, sugar, and salt, then I think that we should be restricting those type of claims. And the legislation did plan to do that, so they intended to set some kind of nutrient profiling system to really stop unhealthy products or HFSS products from making claims. But why, nearly two decades later, we've still not seen anything published at an EU level. So many discussions back and forth. There was some renewed interest in the recent farm to fork strategy, although that seems to have waned, and sustainability legislation seems to have come to the fore. So still the jury's out. Unhealthy products can still make nutrition and health claims. From a UK perspective, there's no official government view on whether nutrient profiles should be set. We've got HFSS criteria, but nothing to stop those type of products from making claims. But there was a recent report from the House of Lords, and they did recommend to implement these nutrient profiles to restrict these types of claims being made. That's the gap. Some potential solutions. I've pulled some international examples of how nutrient profiling is done in other countries, because it can be a bit of an abstract concept when you try and think about it. But pulling international examples. So a good example is in the US. So the US have got nutrient profiles, so nutrient thresholds for fat, sugar, and salt. And if a product is wanting to make a nutrition or a health claim, and they're above any of those thresholds, they've got to make a mandatory disclosure. So you might say that something is high in fiber, but if it's also high in fat, you'd make a mandatory disclosure in the US. Not an outright restriction, but still a labelling requirement. Australia, New Zealand, slightly more restrictive. So they've got what's known as the nutrient profile scoring criterion. And it's a bit like HFSS, takes into account positive and negative nutrients. But any products that fail this model are essentially restricted from making nutrition and health claims altogether. And arguably even more restrictive, so countries in Latin America, you've got quite a few now using front of pack warning labels. So where you've got excessive salt, fat and sugar, and come in like these black octagon labels. I always think of them kind of evil twin to red traffic lights. But similarly, for these front of pack warning labels, where you've got them on pack, you can't make nutrition and health claims in countries like Mexico. That's first gap. Second gap, that on botanical claims. So botanical claims, things like ashwagandha and lion's mane, at the time of the legislation, lots of claims were going through approval processes, so thousands of claims were going through. And there was this category of claims called botanical claims that related to things like ashwagandha that were put on hold because of a lack of human studies. So there's a lot of evidence of traditional use and evidence that's kind of different to typical scientific randomized control trials, observational evidence. The EU Commission thought, okay, we don't know how to assess these, we'll put them on hold and leave it down to businesses in a way. So there's nothing to stop individual businesses from still using these claims, but the onus is on that business to hold some kind of substantiation for it. And it can be a bit frustrating because there's not much guidance out there about what substantiation means. Different enforcement officers, local authorities can potentially interpret it differently. So it is quite a difficult area to get your head around. And at an EU level, it's even more complex. You've got 27 member states, and some member states have got lists of authorised botanicals. Some have got lists of botanicals that are considered medicine. So if you're exporting a supplement to a different member state, you're potentially facing different restrictions, different rules, and how that product would be classified. And all of that means that you've got variations in enforcement, inconsistent penalties, and not much guidance about how to actually substantiate these types of claims. And because of that, well, the reason why is because there's not a unified list in the UK, in the EU, of botanicals and kind of where they sit in the regulatory frameworks. So what potential solutions for botanical claims? It's a lot easier said than done. But first thing first, reject any that have already been negatively assessed. So some of the claims are really kind of beyond, really outrageous, but they're still on hold. So if a business thinks they can substantiate it, there's nothing to stop them from doing so, even though you might have regulators that have already negatively rejected them. So I'd say from a regulatory perspective, complete no-go, but it's still a bit of a grey area. After that, then review those remaining claims. Again, easier said than done. How can you go about doing that? I think at least making a decision on the type of evidence that is needed for these types of claims to be authorised would be a start for them. It might not be that we've got loads of randomised control trials, but can we accept traditional use evidence like we do with some other regulated products? When you've got that, that helps with putting together a coordinated approach for botanical supplements, whether that's a harmonized list of authorized botanicals, potentially a negative list if there's known toxicity. There might be issues that come through that. So recently we saw at EU level, there was a court judgment that was against the EU commissioned recent, or not so recent, but the legal case was recent, as decision to restrict aloe vera preparations. So it's something that the EU's looked at before, but recently faced legal challenges. So I think whether we get an authorised list, it's the jury's out. As part of that, having some kind of clear distinction between food and supplements at, let's say, UK level or at a EU level, so then businesses are clear when they're marketing a product, what the rules are, would it be classed as a supplement, and make sure it's not a medicine. And then last gap, and I arguably think this is one of the biggest gaps, particularly because of how rapidly it's developed. I feel like every event I go to, every room I'm in, social media comes up as a topic. It's a topic that people just don't know what to do with. The regulators struggle to even get them in a room and discuss the problem. So no exception with nutrition and health claims. You've got social media that plays such a big role in advertising. And that's foods, that's food supplements, but it's everything. Everything's advertised across these digital platforms. And with nutrition and health claims regulation, it does apply to all commercial communications, but there's still a bit of lack of clarity in how health claims legislation applies online. And that's because your definition for commercial communication is quite vague. Does it always apply to social media? What about things like influencer marketing? And there's not really any guidance on how to enforce nutrition and health claims online. And I think this is quite a concern because you've now got so many posts, things from influencers, from celebrities, that are blurring that line between commercial and non-commercial content. And we know they've got to make that disclosure, hashtag ad, or any disclosure that comes through. But at the EU, and even in the UK, the actual level of compliance of that is fairly low, which is quite concerning. I think especially concerning from me. So my background in nutrition policy, work a lot with nutritionists and dietitians. And in the nutrition health claims regulation, there are specific restrictions. So nutritionists, dietitians can't endorse products, can't make nutrition and health claims about them, but nothing in the legislation to stop influencers or celebrities. And one of our training course examples, so we've got a pack of fish fingers that David Beckham endorsed quite a while back. And if you had a dietitian doing that, who arguably got more nutrition information, completely restricted, but nothing to stop David Beckham from claiming that on pack. And it's the same when you see influencer and celebrity posts as well. If they're not healthcare professional, then they don't need to worry. And of course, all of that can lead to risk of unverified and misleading claims. So what's a potential solution? And I think UK is quite a good example because we've got the Advertising Standards Authority that does a lot of work on this and puts out guidance and sets definitions. But more widely, EU level and even UK to an extent, having a clearer definition of commercial communication and understanding how that relates to social media. So if you've got definitions for things like influencer marketing, or at least guidance for how influencers are regulated by this piece of legislation, then you can understand where it sits. So having a definition of influencer marketing, you could either bring influencers onto the same level as nutrition professionals, or give nutrition professionals more power and possibly further restrict influencers who have not got that credible background. When you've got that clear definition, having comprehensive guidelines for online enforcement, again, the UK is quite good because we've got the ASA and they do a lot of guidance out there, but it's still self-regulatory. So if you had a clearer definition of commercial communication, you'd have guidance more widely from people like DEFRA and DHSC. And then the last potential solution is that of AI-based ad monitoring systems. Pulled the example again from the ASA because I think it puts into practice quite well how this might work. So this is a graph that I pulled from the ASA, looking at how many ads they were picking up per month based on a new AI tool that they'd integrated into their monitoring activities. So Q4 2022, they were picking up around 14,000 ads with that AI system. Q3 2024, they're picking up 3 million per month, which to me shocked me as a figure. I had a big discussion with ASA about how this was going to affect business and enforcement, because I'm thinking if you give power to a machine, where's the line with enforcement? And they did reassure me in a way, but said that any enforcement action would still have human involvement. So although they're picking up 3 million ads per month, my big question, it's still an open question from ASA, I didn't really get an answer, is how can you filter that level of ads through a regulator and still have human involvement if you're planning to look through all of them? Or how do you prioritise in a way that's not biased? But I think the jury's still out and we'll see with that. And I think it's quite important because I was chatting to ASA and they're planning to publish a strategy next year, which the intention is to pick up 20% of all enforcement actions through AI. So it'd still be filtered by their experts internally, but it shows you the power that they're trying to integrate it through. So that's pretty much it. I've looked at some gaps, some solutions. Why do I think they're important? Nutrient profiles, important for preventing unhealthy products from misleading claims. On-hold botanical claims, having some guidance, what level of substantiation is required, have that regulatory clarity on how you can make them. And then social media, really, having proper guidance out there, like from the ASA, to create that level playing field for businesses, and especially to give value to those businesses who are already doing the right thing, already following guidance, and creating that level playing field. That's everything from me. I'll take any questions now.
Thank you so much. You open the floor for questions. Any questions?
Yeah. Hiya. Your first point around the nutrient profiles for products that are, say, high in fat, sugar, and salt, would that be in line with the nutrient profile model, what was discussed back in 2009, or might it be a different nutrient profile?
So what was discussed back in 2009 at the EU level was setting thresholds for fat, saturated fat, sugar, and salt, above which you would then not be able to make a claim. From a UK perspective, we've done everything HFSS, nutrient profiling model. So if the current government, my personal view is, if they listen to House of Lords recommendation and pick up nutrient profiles to restrict claims, then they'd pick HFSS. So your HFSS products would be those that are facing the claims. But I think until you see political direction of where they want to go, it's difficult.
Hello, I work for a food brand, so I was very interested in hearing what you were saying about the ASA and their AI tool on enforcement, because this is probably half a question, maybe just a request for you to say some more, but we're not perfect, but we try to do things the right way, whereas we see a lot of competitors either deliberately or accidentally not doing it the right way. Therefore, that AI tool, I was listening to it thinking, brilliant, like, because they've really struggled in the past to be able to enforce because of resource, etc. So I take your point about you need the human intervention, but I was sitting here thinking that sounds like great news. So yeah, just say a bit more about that. I was really interested.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think my concern was when I heard about this, if you've got 3 million ads per month, and I didn't know much about
big figure.
Inner work, and I'm thinking, how can they filter that through the small number of people that they've got? Again, they weren't too sure about how they'd be able to do that, but I think it's good because before ASA would always carry out manual searches, so they'd have all of their officers sat in offices looking at claims online, or they'd rely on complaints, but actually a lot of enforcement didn't come from complaints. It was more that manual searching in-house. So my understanding from this is, and I could have mentioned that on the slide, is that this is more about efficiency for them, really reducing time for manual searches, so that they might be picking up 3 million, they might not be able to check the compliance of them all at this stage, but it's saving the time to identify the ads. So then at least they're working from a filtered amount rather than having to do all that manual themselves. But I think until we start seeing adjudications and even how it relates to HFSS, because we've got restrictions coming in next year which are specific for paid for online advertising. So whether the ASA attempt to use that as well, I'm not too sure. But I think their intention is to try and pull out good examples as well, so that when they are producing guidance, they're not just saying, don't do this, this is an adjudication, but hopefully trying to pull out good examples of what businesses are doing as well.
Hi, you talked about the gap with botanicals and the health claims there. In industry, and I think this was touched upon yesterday, but we feel there's also a gap in terms of just macronutrient and micronutrient claims and what we can and can't use. Do you see any solutions or where that might go? Or because at the moment, that's a big sort of... Well, it's not a question mark. It's just we can't do a lot in that space.
Yeah. Is there any particular macronutrients or do you mean the thresholds at which they currently sit?
And it was touched on yesterday, like gut health. We know that's something that's really popular, but there's not much we can say, or like just general, like... with all the vitamin D or what, there's only certain things we can say which from a marketing point of view aren't the sexiest of things that we can claim. So I just wondered if you had any thoughts in that space and what solutions could be possible.
Yeah, it's difficult. I think when you talk about gut health, that brings me to probiotics, and then you're completely restricted, especially UK, because you're talking general claims. And it's frustrating because I don't think EFSA or even the UK equivalent has kept up with how science has changed, and some claims could be reviewed differently. Like in US, you've got quite different systems for food supplements versus food, for example. So how could you do it? I think it's seeing how the market changes, because I used to work at Danone, and at Danone it was all your immune claims on Actimel, and before that it was quite a safe claim that they had general and front of pack. They connected it with vitamin D and B6. And then they decided to take a bit of a risk and go immune support. They changed the wording. Now pretty much all of the market uses that immune support. That's fine. They've not had any pushback. And I think when big players or the market starts to shift and enforcement's not taken place, then you go. But I am concerned a bit where you've got enforcement now who can issue improvement notices to businesses, so like they might be more active in that space. But yeah, it's difficult to say with claims because you've got this framework that's in place that is could do with being updated, but until you get some political action capital behind it, then I can't see things changing too much.
Hello, just a question on botanical on hold claims, please. If they've been on hold for so long, is there a danger that that list could simply be scrapped, or what might the future hold? I think it's quite concerning.
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think it's more the EU not wanting to make a decision, because there is evidence for these botanical claims. There's evidence out there. It's just not standard evidence like randomised control trials and human studies. So I don't really want to comment on whether there's potential for it to be scrapped, and maybe it's just they can't make a decision, so it's on hold. Because in that time as well, a lot of evidence like randomised controlled trials or other studies have come out. So that's why they put that onus on businesses, really, to substantiate it. Now, because there's no guidance on how you do that, is it one study that you need to find? Is it a systematic review? Is it multiple human studies? There's guidance on certain aspects, but not botanical specifically. So I think businesses will benefit more from just knowing what level of substantiation required. And I'd hope that they don't just scrap it and give it up as a bad job, especially when they've left it nearly a decade for botanical claims and have let businesses do what they want. But I think with, just compare it to US, because that's what I'm familiar with as well. In the US, it's very similar for supplements. If you hold the substantiation as a business, then you can notify it to FDA, the federal authority, and you can use that claim. So I see it currently as quite a similar system, apart from you've just not got the guidance there for botanical claims. It's something we help clients with at Camden, but we typically go for a literature review. The danger with that is it might not produce the results that you want. You'd have to have quite a good understanding of a claim that you're making, or at least the literature, to just randomly do a literature search on a claim and hope that it fits. So, yeah, I don't know how it'll go with botanicals, but nothing's changed in like the last 10 years, so I guess wait and see.
Thank you for that. It was really useful. You were mentioning about the ads and how there's 3 million ads in just one quarter, but there's also individual people now on TikTok, for example, making their own advertisements and their own storefronts. I was just wondering, is that being regulated in any way? You know, because if the brands aren't even being regulated, who's to say that individual people are being regulated?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you could speak to that.
No, it's a perfect question because it ties in so much into what I'm looking at PhD-wise, because you've got things like TikTok now that are becoming marketplaces, and you've already not got regulation in place for aggregators like meal delivery apps. It's almost like they're all colliding in a way, but regulation, no. Which is frustrating because...
It makes some health claims, you're like, that's insane.
Exactly. And I've been tempted to submit complaints to ASA before, but just the speed of getting that through. So I'd hope that this tool can pick up on things. Yeah. But I think the legal grey area that is social media platforms selling food, Facebook Marketplace, another example. I think it's going to be a while before we see anything. That's interesting.
Just as a follow-on on that, because we know that the term a nutritionist is not a protected title at all. Yeah. If it was to be protected, would that really make any difference? So you can't claim to be a nutritionist just because you've done a course on wherever for 6 months or something like that?
See, nutritionist is quite, it's not, you know, protected in term like a dietitian is, but it's still got the Association for Nutrition and people... And I think a lot of people do it through that way. My concern was even if they were registered similar to a dietitian, the legislation is still the same. It still says that healthcare professionals, extends to nutritionists, can't endorse products, arguably make nutrition and health claims, which for me, that needs tweaking. I think we should be empowering nutrition professionals to be able to make that kind of advice, not really wildly, but then, or bringing influencers into scope, because what law does anyone pull on? Say, okay, you're an influencer, you say you're a health expert, but you make, it's difficult. But I think they need some changes to legislation to be able to capture those.
Do you have any thoughts on a UPF framework, or if, you know, how it would look, or is it totally down to political will, or is there a way that it would come in, or how it would shape?
Yeah, such a good question. And to be honest, before, I've been giving presentations on UPF pretty much all year, and I was going to bring one here, but I thought I'd be put with supplements. I'll switch to nutrition health claim. So I could easily talk about Nova and UPF all day. But my personal view, I think UPF has been good at drawing attention to nutrition issues, i.e. getting a House of Lords report together to make recommendation for public health. Nova, I think it's a good direction of travel. I don't think it should be applied at product level, and I don't think it should be used as a weapon to demonise industry either, like it has been done by media. I think my prediction for how UPF will go is either nutrient profiling models like HFSS start to integrate markers of processing, if you start to find, like, because there's so much funding going into UPF now, because that's where all the money is in nutrition. So one method, HFSS, incorporating processing into that. Another, and I think we'll see this fairly soon, a model that's developed to target, to capture ultra-processed food, but do so using nutrition. So in Latin America, you've got those black octagon warning labels, and I think over 90% of those black octagon warning labels are on products that are UPF, but that model's based on nutrition, so you can't argue against it, which is the big thing against Nova. I think that's another direction. And I'm pretty sure in the next couple of years, we'll see a model published by researchers that tries to do that. Or another final way, I think, is more that subcategorization of NOVA. UPF is such a wide topic. NOVA 4, it's not a fair comparison to me because you've got such a variety of product. So I think breaking NOVA 4 down into lots of different subcategories will be where it goes. And I do think it'll come back to nutrition. I think it'll just come back to HFSS, the 13 product categories that are already in scope of UK restrictions. But from a policy point of view, I think they'll ignore it for a long time and maintain nutrition. And that's what House of Lords recommended as well. They just said more research on UPF, let's stick with HFSS and work from that.
Would you like to join me once again in thanking Lewis for the fantastic talk?
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Before you go, we've got some exciting news to share about more live events this year. We're heading to Ascot in October and Dublin in November. And for the first time, we're hosting an event in mainland Europe. In September 2025, we'll be in Rotterdam. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com.